Okay, we're now doing talk number 32 in the Matthew commentary series. We're in Matthew chapter 14, and we are now at verse 22. And it reads, "Then he made the disciples get into the boat and go before him to the other side, while he dismissed the crowds." Now, let me just say a few things about this. The word "made," he made the disciples, is significant. Jesus ordered them to go from there. Now, bear in mind, they'd only just shortly before come here. They'd come to this place, which is on the northeast side of Lake Galilee, because they wanted to move away from the area of jurisdiction that belonged to Herod Antipas. So where they went to on the northeast side of Galilee was under the jurisdiction of Herod Philip, who was the other brother, not the one that had fallen out with John the Baptist. So that's where they had gone to, and that's where the feeding of the 5,000 took place, on the northeast corner side of Lake Galilee. Jesus then makes them go again, so they go, according to verse 22, to the other side. Okay. Now, the reason why Jesus made them do so emerges when you look at John's Gospel. John 6:5 helps to explain this, because it shows that it says in John 6:15, not John 6:5. It says, "Perceiving then that they were about to come and take him by force to make him king, Jesus withdrew again to the mountain by himself." Now, that episode spoken of in John 6:15 is the feeding of the 5,000. Now, the miracle he carried out there so enthused the crowd, and they were so pleased with him and so excited by it, they wanted to make him king by force. And so Jesus wasn't going to have that, and there are a number of reasons why he didn't want that. The first, of course, is that he'd already been rejected by the leadership of the nation and by most of the people. They'd already rejected his offer of the kingdom, and they'd already committed the unpardonable sin whereby they'd attributed to Satan the things that he was doing, and rather than to the Holy Spirit. That had happened, which is the very reason why he'd withdrawn the offer of the kingdom. So he wasn't going to let them force him to become king when he himself had withdrawn the offer of becoming king and Messiah. And so he wasn't... that was the first reason. He'd withdrawn it. The second, of course, is he's not willing to be made king by force. It's not the job of that crowd to make him king. And he's not willing to have anybody force him into anything. Thirdly, that their motives were not right. Some of them, at least, didn't genuinely want to be his disciples. They were excited by the feeding of the 5,000 or the 15 or 20,000. They were excited by that, and they wanted more of that. And some of them probably just were excited by getting food, others just by the miracles, and they wanted that. And that's not the right motive. We need to make him king because we want him to be king, not because we can get things. But we see the same thing today in many churches, where people want things, or they want things that Jesus might do rather than wanting him. Do you see? And that's not a pedantic distinction. We're supposed to want him. We're supposed to be disciples of him, not simply the pursuers of certain things that he might do. And fourthly, the reason he wasn't wanting to cooperate with them is that when he does become king, it will be in Jerusalem, not in Galilee. He's not going to be made king in the northern part of Israel, alongside Lake Galilee. That's not the place for it. Jesus wants to do things in the right way, at the right time, for the right reasons. And he's not willing to be manipulated or forced into things by others, whatever their reasons might be. He does what's right, not what people want him to do. So let me preface it by saying that. So that's why the disciples were sent into a boat whilst he went off into the mountains. Now, where he went, it would seem, was he went up into the Golan Heights. I've been there a number of times, and the Golan Heights are the mountains at the northern end of Lake Galilee, and they were captured from the Syrians in 1973 and have been retained by Israel ever since. Very important range of mountains, because the Syrians used to use them to fire artillery shells down into the Galilee area and even further. So when the Israelis captured the Golan Heights, of course they don't misuse the Golan Heights for anything. They don't use them to fire shells into Syria. The Israelis have no intention of firing any shells anywhere. They just don't want anyone firing shells at them. So the Israelis possess the Golan Heights now. And it was into the Golan Heights that Jesus went on his own whilst he sent the disciples in a boat to cross over. Let me just address also this area, a potential area of confusion. I don't want to get too deep into it because it's quite involved, but if you look carefully at the different parallel accounts within the Gospels of where the feeding of the 5,000 was or appears to be, and which side of the lake did they cross over to, you can end up getting confused. And the confusion arises for this reason. There are two Bethsaidas. All right. There's Bethsaida Julius, which is on the northeast side of Galilee, and then there's Western Bethsaida, which is just called Bethsaida, but that was on the west, northwest side of Galilee. And the point is that the feeding of the 5,000 took place at the northeast side, at Bethsaida Julius. It's called Bethsaida Julius after Herod Philip, because that was one of the names he took. But the thing was that was in his area of jurisdiction, which is the very reason why they were there in the first place, because of the murder of John the Baptist and Jesus wanting to keep his distance from Herod Antipas. But the motivation on the part of the crowd to make him king was sufficient to cause him to reverse that policy, so he sends the disciples back to the northwest, and he meanwhile goes to the Golan Heights to pray. So that's why it's doing that. But if you look closely at the Gospel accounts, you may get confused, because it speaks of how they went to Bethsaida, and you think, well, they're in Bethsaida, they're going to Bethsaida. What's all this about? And then in, I think it's in John, it speaks of how they went to Capernaum. You think, hang on a minute, what's this? What's going on here? Now, to simplify all this, what you have is, you just need to realise that there are two Bethsaidas. And that's why. It's a little bit like, I think on one of the series I did pertaining to how to study the Bible, I spoke about how there's confusion arising out of the healing of blind Bartimaeus. And the Gospel accounts say that this healing occurred on the way to Jericho, but the Gospel accounts also say elsewhere that it occurred on the way out of, as they were leaving Jericho. And you think, well, which is right? Were they entering Jericho or leaving Jericho? The Gospel accounts at separate places say both of those things. And do you know what? Both are correct. And do you know why? Because there are two Jerichos. There's the old Jericho and new Jericho. And so when you're reading the Bible like this, when I was doing my study for this talk, I looked at this and I thought, what's going on here? Why are they, you know, I spot these little apparent discrepancies. And if you're not careful, you could allow those to discourage you. But if you're willing to work at it and keep digging, you'll find after a bit there is an explanation for why there is an apparent discrepancy. The Bible always ends up being right, you see. And I think God rather enjoys putting things into the Bible which give, on the face of it, ostensibly the appearance of a contradiction or an error. And I think he chuckles to himself to say, right, are you going to search for the answer? Or are you going to start saying that you don't get it? If you search hard, you'll find it. And so I searched around for a bit and I found it and got to the bottom of it, that there are two Bethsaidas. And so, the according to many tour guides, the traditional site of the feeding of the 5,000 is on the northwest side of Galilee. But actually that's not correct. It took place on the northeast side. And the biblical account is what we should go by, not local tradition, because local tradition is often just to get you to bring your tour bus to their village so that you can buy their ice cream, you know. And you have to be careful about what you believe, because there's all sorts of traditional sites for this, you know, 3, 4, 5 different sites where such a thing happened. Anyway, that explains that. So, but you need to, when you come across these apparent contradictions, do not be discouraged and do not blame the Bible. Assume every time there is an answer here, I just need to find it. Because it's the glory of God to conceal a matter. It's the glory of kings to search out a matter. And what God does is he hides things in the Bible and he wants you to find them. Some things are obvious, some things are hidden, some things involve a police inquiry to get to the bottom of what's happening. But when that inquiry happens, every time the Bible is right. Every single time. Never, ever, ever is the Bible wrong. And here's an example of it. Alright. So, okay. Right, let's look at verse 23. It says, "And after he had dismissed the crowds, he went up on the mountain by himself to pray. When evening came, he was alone." So he'd fed the 5,000 and their wives and children, and then up he goes into the Golan Heights by himself to pray. Now Jesus did a lot of that, and we need to remember that. Jesus is our model in everything, including prayer time, which is one of the hardest things for people to do. People find prayer so difficult. Well, he's our model, and off he goes on his own to pray by himself. And I think it's not without significance that he was doing that precisely at the time that his disciples were entering into a fierce storm on Lake Galilee. And I think he was praying for them and for their safety. And he was doing that because that needed to be done. Now you might argue, oh, they couldn't possibly be in any danger because, you know, he had called them and they were going to, nothing could happen to them on Lake Galilee. Well, I think the devil was having a shot at it. But he was responding to the situation. He knew what was coming, he knew what was happening, and he prayed for them. And we need to do the same. We mustn't assume fatalistically that all things are inevitable or settled, you know, must happen, as many people, as people from Islam think, Muslims think that, and so too do many extreme Calvinists. Everything's inevitable. No, it's not. We need to pray about things. Even Jesus did. He goes up on the mountain to pray. So what's he doing that for? What's the point of him doing that if everything is simply inevitable? If even he needs to pray, then don't surely we need to pray? It's okay. Now, let's see. Okay, we go to verse 24. It says, "But the boat by this time was many furlongs distant from the land, beaten by the waves, for the wind was against them." Now some versions, including the American Standard Version, says it was in the midst of the sea. So, but in the Revised Standard Version that I'm using, it's saying, it doesn't use that, it says it's many furlongs distant from the land. So it's, the boat is out well into the water. Now do you see the significance of that? All they're doing is going from the northeast to the northwest. They're not going, they aren't meant to be going deep down into the lake. They're just, if you know, if you ever look at Galilee, it's long and not very wide. They were just crossing at a very narrow point. But they're driven by the wind, this is the point. They're blown by the wind towards the middle of the lake. And they're having to row. And we know from John chapter 6 verse 19 that they rowed 4 miles when they saw Jesus walking on the sea. So they were 4 miles in. And we also know that they were in the storm for about 9 hours. Now, it shouldn't take 9 hours to cross from the northeast to the northwest, especially if you're experienced fishermen and there's plenty of you to share the rowing and take turns at rowing. They should have been able to manage it in less than that. But the point was, they had this fierce storm working against them. So there they were, rowing westward from Bethsaida Julius, which is where the feeding of the 5,000 took place, on the northeast shore to western Bethsaida, which is near Capernaum and near Gennesaret on the western side. Now they could have just followed the shoreline, where it was shallow and less difficult, but they're obviously being blown into the centre of the sea by the wind, which is obviously not where they would wish to go, but that's where they're being blown. But note, it says in verse 25, "And in the fourth watch of the night he came to them, walking on the sea." Now the fourth watch is between 3 a.m. and 6 a.m. That's what we would call it. They would call it the fourth watch. Now, the thing is, that's 9 hours since they had started sailing this boat. So Jesus has left them in this storm for 9 hours. And then he comes walking over to them. But notice it says he's walking, not running. Do you see the way Jesus operates? He takes all those hours to come, because he's up on the mountain praying. And then he comes to the lake and walks over to them. But he doesn't increase the speed of his pace. He just walks towards them. Because Jesus isn't panicking. He's not worried. He's not in a panic. And I think if I was on the boat with them, I'd have been saying to Jesus, can we possibly see an increase in speed here? Because we're in danger of drowning in this boat. But Jesus deliberately leaves them for all those hours. And in a sense, we need to take encouragement from this. He leaves them for hours in what many of us would regard as a crisis. These are experienced fishermen and they can't get to the shore. And they're in danger by this severe storm. But he lets them go through it. He doesn't immediately rescue them. And he won't immediately rescue us either. And we mustn't look upon the turbulent events of our own lives as if there was something strange or weird was happening. It's quite normal for Jesus to come and help us by walking, do you see? Mm-hmm. And that's no wrong on his part. If he chooses to walk to help us, it's because he wants us to learn something from the storm. So these fellas had to learn something from the storm, and so do we, because there are going to be plenty of them. And never ever think that Jesus is letting you down when you're in a storm, because he's not. He's never letting you down under any circumstances. He's never wrong, he's never unfaithful, he's always on your side, doesn't matter what's happening. If you can't understand what Jesus is doing, well then just say to yourself, I can't understand what Jesus is doing. Just say that. But never blame him or attribute to him any wrong motive or say that he's letting you down. Because the one thing that you do know is that he's not doing any of that. Okay, so there he comes, walking along. And we're not told in the Gospel account how he does this exactly. What's the condition of the water? Does he have to walk up and down over the waves? Or do the waves part to make a smooth path for him? Do his feet get wet? Does his robe get wet? Now these shatteringly important questions are not considered shatteringly important by the Holy Spirit, because he doesn't choose to mention any of these things. And these are just areas of curiosity. Which I have. I'm very curious about these things. But the point is, the Bible deals with what the Bible deals with. God, for some reason, did not consider it vital for us to know whether Jesus' feet got wet. And he's left that out. So we need to content ourselves with knowing that he simply walked across the lake to them. And those little incidental ancillary details simply need to be set to one side. Nothing wrong with asking questions, but the point is that the Bible doesn't tell you everything that you want to know. It tells you everything that you need to know. That's the point. Verse 26, it says, "But when the disciples saw him walking on the sea, they were terrified, saying, 'It is a ghost,' and they cried out for fear." Now, I suppose you can understand that. It's relatively uncommon for people to walk across Lake Galilee. When I was on a trip the other year, I was on a trip with Arnold Fruchtenbaum. It's a 5-week trip doing biblical geography, which is one of my weak points, geography. But I thought I'd try and supplement it by going with Arnold, who's a real expert on geography, the whole geography of Israel. But when we were there, one day we had a day off on a the Sabbath, and we had a day off. And I just said, there are a bunch of Americans on the tour, mostly Americans. And because I'm English and dry, I never announce when I'm telling a joke. And they asked us what we were doing, what we'd been doing during the day. And I just said in a nonchalant tone, I said, oh, well, I took a short walk across the lake, and then I did this and this and this. And I was well into the next thing that I was saying I'd done, about doing my laundry and so forth, before they got it. And they said, what did you say? Across the lake. So the thing is that these disciples, when they saw a man walking towards them in the night on the water, you can understand why they'd be scared. And they were just like us. This is the point. The disciples were very like us. We'd be scared if a man was walking to us across the lake. And these have been fishermen all their lives, and it's the first time they've seen it happen. And when it did, they cried out for fear. But look what Jesus does in verse 27. He says, but immediately he spoke to them, saying, take heart, it is I, have no fear. And so many times in the Bible, we're told either to have no fear or to have courage. So for a high proportion of the time, we don't need to be afraid at all. And then for a minority of the time, we do. It is justified to be afraid, and on such occasions, the Bible tells us to have courage. Now here, Jesus doesn't tell them to have courage. Why doesn't he tell them to have courage? Because there's nothing to be afraid of, do you see? Now there are other times when there is something to be afraid of. So let's imagine we face persecution for the sake of the gospel. At such times, we need to have courage. Why courage? Why not be fearless? Well, because there's something to fear. The thing that we have to fear is persecution or death or whatever. But in this situation, there was no danger because he was with them. Therefore, what they needed was to not be afraid. Do you see? And the Bible distinguishes carefully between not being afraid and being courageous. And we need at various times either to be one or the other. We need to either be unafraid because there's nothing to be afraid of, which is overwhelmingly, majority of the time, there's nothing to be afraid of. And on that minority of occasions when there is something tangible and real to be afraid of, then be courageous. Do you see the point? Because he's just as with us as he was with them. You mustn't imagine that Jesus was more with them than he is with us. The mere fact that they could see him is academic. The point is, he's just as much with you and me as he was with them. And I have a vivid imagination, but I just find it easy to imagine him being with me. I find it easy to believe that he's always with me, and I don't doubt it. As I often say, I could give a character reference for him. If he was on trial for something, I would be able to appear and say to the magistrates, I know this man. He spends every day with me, and I can testify to his character, his faithfulness, his stickability. He's always on my side. He's always with me. Never let me down yet. And that's the point, you see. And you mustn't imagine, oh, well, yeah, but Jesus favoured the disciples. No. He was their friend, but he's not my friend. Do you see that? He was with them, but he's not with us. Do you see how people imagine? He's no more with them than he is with you. You can't have degrees of presence, can you? He's either with or not with you. The fact is, he's with you. And he's with you always. He tells us that he is. And so it's important for these things not to treat them as arcane academic points of doctrine, so that whether or not Jesus is with you is some kind of esoteric theological point. It's not. It's a practical, realistic point of fact that we need to know, because it has a material impact. It has very major implications. If Jesus is with us, then we don't drown on Galilee. If Jesus is not with us, then we do drown on Galilee. So that's, some would view that as a significant distinction, you see. And so the point is, He is with us. And you have to get your daily life into line with your theology. Theology is not just for academic situations. It has an impact on the way that you live and think and be. And it changes everything. So if you're facing a crisis or a problem, you know that you have him with you. He has never promised that we'll never have problems. He has promised always to be with us in our problems. Do you see? He's with us in them. Okay, well, maybe I'm labouring that, but perhaps there's someone who needs to know that, even perhaps on the tape. Okay, well, verse 28. And here comes Peter. He says, "And Peter answered him, 'Lord, if it is you, bid me come to you on the water.'" Now, a lot of people have a downer on Peter. They really like to put him down. And I've heard it said, that Peter was a show-off and a big head, and he was conceited, and he was arrogant, and he was always wanting to draw attention to himself, and so forth and so on. All sorts of baseless accusations are levelled against him, for which there's no foundation, and which is not borne out by fact or by Jesus' response to what Peter did. So look what he's saying here. He says, "If it's you, bid me to come to you on the water." Now, some people criticise Peter for saying the word "if." There's nothing wrong with him saying "if." He's saying, "If that's you, tell me to come to you." Now, why does he say, "Bid me to come to you," or "tell me," "command me to come to you"? He says, "Command me to come to you," because Peter is being unpresumptuous. It's precisely because he's not presumptuous that he says, "Tell me to come to you." Because if Peter had simply jumped into the water and ran to him, that you might possibly call that presumption. Because he'd be seeking to do, in his own enthusiasm, something which he had not been commanded to do. And you see, there's a lesson in verse 28 for us. You can do anything that God tells you to do. But you can't necessarily do something that he hasn't asked you to do. And I write about this in book 5 as well, and elsewhere, about what's called a work of the flesh. And in book 7 too. It's doing something in your own enthusiasm, in your own impulse, your own motivation, your own initiative, your own inventiveness, which he hasn't asked you to do. And I liken it to being like an over-enthusiastic bricklayer on a building site who just starts building things here, there and everywhere where the architect or the clerk of works doesn't want them built. Well, they're just going to have to come down again. And the architect and the clerk of works and the site foreman are not going to give him help and cooperation in building those things. Do you see? Why not? Because they don't want them. So there you are, you're some junior bricklayer, you're very enthusiastic, and you think, this would be an excellent place for me to put a nice brick-built flower bed. And so you start building it. Along comes the clerk of works, and he's not helping you, he's not supporting you, moreover, he has orders the thing to be torn down. Because what you were doing was not what he wanted. And so, if we do what Jesus wants us to do, he will give us the power to do the thing that he wants us to do. But if we do something he hasn't asked us to do, didn't want us to do, he will not give us the power to do it. Now, that would then be a situation which is called presumption. You're just doing something by yourself because you just want to do it. And that could be a very good thing that you're doing. You could be joining some committee, embarking on some project, joining some ministry, doing something or other that you think is a good idea. But you've never asked God, does he want you to do it? I've been guilty of this countless times because I'm enthusiastic by nature. And I join things quickly, I act on impulse, or I did. I do so less these days. And you find out that you're doing something that you haven't been called to do. And so now I would pause and ask, is it what you want me to do? And Peter, notwithstanding that so many people have a downer on him and criticise him, he's actually a model to us in this. He doesn't step on the water until Jesus tells him to. So he's not doing it on impulse or presumptuously. Quite the reverse. Because he's saying, if I get commanded to do this thing, if I'm commanded to do it, I will have the power to do it. And so, Jesus, in verse 29, it says, he said, "Come." So Peter got out of the boat and walked on the water and came to Jesus. All right. Now, how do I know that Jesus didn't think that Peter was being presumptuous, arrogant, proud, a show-off, an exhibitionist, and all these things that people accuse him of being? How do I know? Because Jesus told him to come. If Jesus thought he was motivated by all those kind of inappropriate feelings and ideas, Jesus would have said, stay in the boat. If that's what you're thinking, if you're just trying to come out on the water to show off, Peter, then stay in the boat. Jesus knew perfectly well that was not Peter's motivation. His motivation was he wanted to be with Jesus, he wanted to do what Jesus was doing, he wanted to grow, he wanted to develop, he wanted to try new things, he wanted to show faith, he wanted to be the utmost he could be. And if you're like that, you will be knocked by others. I know it for myself, because I've wanted to be the most I can be, do the best I can do, learn as much as I can learn. And people have knocked that, in particular insecure leaders who feel threatened by your wanting to do things that they aren't doing or can't do or have never tried to do or wouldn't dare to try to do. When people see that in you, they will try and knock you. And I just mention this, if nothing else, for the tape, because there might be someone who's facing that. And I would say, take heart. Do not think that there's something wrong with wanting to go to the utmost. Go to the utmost. That's not presumption. That's faith. It's presumption when you're doing it on your own say-so, because you think it, without asking whether it's what God wants. It's faith when you're asking God, what do you want me to do? And then you try to do it. That's faith. So Peter asks Jesus, command me to come, bid me to come, and then I'll be able to come. So Jesus says, yes, come. Now, come is an instruction. So therefore, because he's been instructed to do it, he's able to do it. So Peter gets out of the boat and walks on the water. Now again, I'm leaping to the defense of Peter on this, because so many people then say, in what happens next, that he is a person who lacks faith, because he begins to sink in a moment. And talk about seeing a glass half empty. If there was ever a situation of seeing a glass half empty, that would be it. What you see here is evidence of fantastic and dramatic faith at a level beyond any of the disciples. John wasn't out there, James wasn't out there, Andrew wasn't out there, Matthew himself, the writer of this gospel, he wasn't out there on the water. Peter was, do you see? Now, you'll find, especially if you're a young person, if you're wanting to take risks for God, to go to the nth degree for him, to try things for him, if you want to do things that he's calling you to, others around you will want to knock you down. And I'm talking now within the church, not outside it. I'm not talking about unbelievers. Of course unbelievers will knock you down. I'm talking about people in the church. I'm talking about leaders. Many leaders will knock you down if you're trying something that they haven't done or daren't do or can't do and so on. But don't let it stop you. In your own particular situation that corresponds to this, get out on the water. If Jesus is commanding you to do something, get out and do it. Provided, of course, that he's commanding you to do it, which you must first establish without leaping to conclusions about it. But if Jesus is calling you to something or commanding something, first of all, he will enable you to do that which he commands you to do. And so, therefore, you will be enabled. But he'll also be with you in it and support you in it. It might be turbulent, it might be difficult, but he'll be with you in it and he'll help you in it. So Peter is in fact a model to us here of what a person should be like. He was the only one of the disciples to ask to be commanded to come out onto the water. The others didn't even ask, let alone try it. Okay, so let's see what happens next. He says, but when he saw the wind, in verse 30, but when he saw the wind, he was afraid, and beginning to sink, he cried out, Lord, save me. Okay. Now, what we have here, we don't know how many steps he took, but it would seem several. because Jesus wasn't sufficiently close to the boat for them to be able to immediately see who he was. I would guesstimate that Jesus was several yards from the boat. That's my sort of guess. Otherwise, if he was right outside the boat, then they would have seen him. And secondly, if he was right by the boat, what's the point of getting on the water with him? He might as well, you know, stand by the side of the boat and talk to him. Peter wanted to go to Jesus some yards away. Now, before he began to sink, he'd already walked, I think, a distance, some yards, taken several steps. So what was it that Peter was seeing that was making him begin to lose his faith? He says, when he saw the wind. What it means is, when he saw the evidence of the wind, namely, the sideways water coming at him and the billowing waves on the, and when he felt the wind and he saw the water being raised up by it. So he looked at the water and that's when he began to panic. So what he began to do was to do the thing that Jesus told him not to do, which is to fear. Now remember, Jesus had said in an earlier verse, have no fear, it is I. You see? So he looked at the waves and he began to fear. Now this was not a situation where he needed courage. It was a situation where he needed not to be afraid. Do you see? And the situation could have been different. He could have been, you know, in a position where of real danger, and he then would need to have courage. But the point is, he looks at the waves, he looks at the storm and the evidence of the storm, and he begins to panic. And that's when he begins to sink, because he takes his eyes off Jesus. He's been walking to Jesus, looking at him, no doubt, but then he began to look at the waves around him, and that's when he began to lose his confidence and lose his faith. And there's a lesson to us as well, because if you are in a crisis situation, if you keep focused on who Jesus Christ is, on obeying him, on trusting him, on believing him, on going to him, keep him as your focus, you won't be afraid, because he's your focus. But if you focus on the thing you're afraid of, not him, then you'll end up afraid. And if you end up afraid, then unless you can force yourself to show a great deal of courage, you're going to end up most probably losing your faith on that particular point and chickening out, panicking. Okay. So the thing is, that was Peter's mistake, is to look at the waves instead of looking at Jesus. He'd started well looking at Jesus, then he started to look at the waves. Instead, he should have kept looking at Jesus and remembering how big and powerful and immense he is. And that's what we need to do in the storms that we face. And I think I've got better at this over the years. You know, 20 years ago or whatever, I think I was less confident, less resolute, more fearful, more anxious than I am now. I think I've lost a lot of that, because I've simply got to know him better. I've seen him do things over and over and over again. I know his modus operandi. If we were in a police station, we'd say of Jesus, what's his MO? Modus operandi. And I know his modus operandi. I know how he works. I know it. And you can trust him. And keep focusing on him, not on the situation, the circumstances, what other people are doing, what they might do, and so on. So, far from criticizing Peter for this, we need to praise him. You know, Jesus thought highly of him. But why do I say that? Well, firstly, who was it that Jesus appointed to be the leader of the disciples? It was Peter. And I think that Jesus was watching the disciples throughout those 3.5 years, getting to know them really well, and in his mind he was thinking, who am I going to appoint to be the leader? And this is the man he chose. Now there was nothing perfect about Peter. Peter wasn't the best writer and the most efficient administrator. That was probably Matthew. You know, he wasn't the youngest. That was John. And there were probably other things he didn't have that some of the others had. But what did he have that made Jesus make him the leader of the disciples? I think it was a holy boldness and an enthusiastic wholeheartedness. Peter was the one that was gung-ho. Now, gung-ho is a pejorative term, a negative expression for boldness, you see. When we say someone's gung-ho, we're talking of their boldness, of their enthusiasm, but we're speaking of it negatively. Peter was gung-ho at times, and he would do things that were not what he was meant to do. But he was doing it it was the misapplication of a quality. And as I often say, a person's greatest faults are frequently their qualities being misused. And Peter's quality was wholeheartedness, boldness, zeal, and love of the Lord. He wanted so much to be the best he could be and to do the best he could do. He wanted it, whereas many people are so dead from the neck up and dead, heart dead. They've got no zeal in them, no passion in them. He's very passionate. And I think Jesus chose Peter for many reasons, but probably also because of the amount of passion and zeal and commitment and enthusiasm and wholeheartedness that he had. And Jesus wasn't put off by the mistakes he made. Neither must you be by the mistakes you make. Because if you set out to achieve anything in life, you'll make more mistakes than the people who don't try. Do you see? The best way to make no mistakes is never to do anything. Never to try anything. Always sit down in a chair and never do say anything or go anywhere or anything at all. And then you won't make any mistakes except for the mistake of not trying things. But other than that, you won't make any. Not visible ones that people can see. But if you want to do well for God, you've got to be willing to fall flat on your face, make mistakes, get it wrong. Far from being angry with Peter, Jesus was pleased with him. And I think Jesus was touched by what happened that day. This was the man that wanted to get out the boat. And I think this, Jesus got out his mobile phone and made a note, make sure to remember this thing about Peter when choosing a leader. Definitely. I don't know where the verse is that says that, but there'll be one. And so the point is, be willing to try things. That's not presumption. Presumption is doing things you weren't asked to do. Courage, faith, zeal, boldness, enthusiasm, wholeheartedness are doing the things that you're meant to do and being willing to do them even though they're very difficult. And of course, the things that God's calling us to do that are going to create these problems for us, they're not going to be go to the shop and get me a pint of milk, are they? That kind of request from God is not going to cause you an awful crisis of faith, is it? It's when he asks you to do something difficult, dangerous, frightening, problematical, something bigger than you've ever done, harder than you've ever done. Now think about it. If you're going to do that for him, do you think God only calls us to do things that are easy or that will succeed first time or that there's no problem, it's just dead easy? Of course not. He's well aware that the things he's calling you to do are difficult. That's why he wants you to have faith. Why do you need to have faith to go to the shop and get a pint of milk? You don't need faith for that. You need faith to do the difficult things he's calling you to do, which will always be bigger than, harder than, further than anything you've done so far. And if it's what he's calling you to, then going for it with a wholehearted attitude is faith. But if it's just your own idea, that's presumption. And wisdom consists in knowing the difference between the two. Okay, well, let's look what Jesus says in verse 31. He says, Jesus immediately reached out his hand and caught him, saying to him, O man of little faith, why did you doubt? Now, when people look at that, again, these the Peter knockers, the ones who are in the inverted Peter fan club, the ones who are against Peter, are saying, there you are, you see, Jesus is telling him off. And I don't see that. I don't see that at all. Jesus isn't telling him off. First of all, he has no reason to. Jesus is totally aware of how difficult we find things. You know, he's not unaware. So one of the purposes of his incarnation was for him to experience the things we experience. It says he grew in wisdom and stature. in Nazareth as he was a young man. He had to experience things, all the things we experience. And when he was at the cross, he experienced fear. He knew what fear was. And bear in mind, you see, he didn't begin to feel fear when the cross was there. Jesus had to anticipate the cross for all eternity. Do you see? He'd always known the cross was coming to him. And he never turned away from it. Do you see? So he knows how difficult things are. And Jesus himself, when he was in Gethsemane, asked God 3 times to take it away from him if it's possible. Now why did he do that? Why did he sweat drops of blood? Because he was terrified. Because he was dreading it. Now, he is not unaware, he's not unmindful of how difficult you find it. See the point? He's totally aware. And when Jesus says this to Peter, he's not telling him off. He's not saying, oh, how lousy you are. What a pathetic disciple you are. How disappointed I am in you. Not in the least. It's quite the opposite. If you can tolerate a footballing metaphor, by which I mean proper football, not American football. If what you've got here, it's a bit like a football manager. He's got a player, a young player. He's on the pitch. He's had a terrific game. He scored 2 goals, but the 3rd shot on goal missed, or he missed a penalty, or he fluffed the 3rd one because he panicked, because the goalkeeper was running out at him and he panicked or something like that. Can you imagine a football manager after that game saying to this young star, some young Roy Keane or some young player, something along the lines of, you could have had a hat-trick. It could have been a hat-trick tonight if you'd not lost your nerve. You see? Is that a rebuke? Or is it praise? That's praise. You see? Now, the point is, Jesus is like that. He's saying to you, you could have done better. But it's praise. It contains praise. Jesus is pleased with him. And he's not criticizing him. We know that objectively, Peter did not have little faith. He had a lot of faith. It's just that relative to what he could have and what Jesus would want him to have, it was little. So even what Peter did is less than Jesus knew he could do and knew that he would do one day. Do you see? And so the thing is, Jesus is totally on Peter's side, not at all sneering or belittling or complaining or criticizing, not at all. That's totally to misunderstand him. He's saying, you could have made it all the way. You didn't need to look at the waves, you need to look my way, and you could have made it. That's not a rebuke. He's telling him, next time, don't panic. Do you see? Okay, and verse 32, it says, and when they got into the boat, the wind ceased. Now, do you see the miracle in that? It's quite common for storms on the Sea of Galilee to come up. They can come quite quickly. But there's one thing they never do. They never end quickly. A storm on Galilee always peters out. They can rise fast, but they peter out slowly. This one just stopped. So as soon as Jesus got into the boat, the storm just stopped. And all these waves just went straight down. I wish I could have seen that. But that's what happened. That was a miracle just as he stepped into the boat. And they could see that was a miracle. These were experienced fishermen. They'd seen storms before. They had never seen a storm just stop like that. Mm. Not in their own human experience. They knew it was supernatural. Well, one reason why we know that is because of what they say next. In verse 33, it says, and those in the boat worshipped him, saying, truly, you are the Son of God. Now, these are things that would never be said, or Jesus would never permit to be said, if he was not God. You see, because often people say, I've heard people say this, Jesus never claimed to be God. You know, the disciples just thought he was God. Do you see? Well, if that was true, and if they began to worship him, If Jesus was only an observant Jew, not God, not the Son of God, and he saw men worshipping him and calling him the Son of God, he would be appalled, you see. In a similar manner to how, at a lesser level, Apostle Paul, when people thought he was a Greek god, they thought he was Hermes, a Greek god. Apostle Paul was aghast at the idea of people thinking he was not just a man. Do you see? The angels, whenever people have wrongly attempted to worship an angel, the angel is always appalled and tells them to stop it straight away. But look here. They worship him in the boat, and they tell him he's the Son of God. He does not contradict them. He allows them to worship him. He does not contradict them. He doesn't tell them that he's not the Son of God. Now, if he wasn't, he would have stopped them, he'd have contradicted them, and he'd have rebuked them severely, because that would have been a terrible sin. Do you see? You shall have no gods before me. No other gods before me is one of the commandments. Well, if he had not been God, these men would have been breaking that commandment by worshipping someone who's not God. And he would have, as an observant Jew, he'd been appalled by that. Do you see the point? And that's just one instance, but there are many, many instances where it's as plain as day that Jesus claims to be God. Plain as day. Okay. Well, let's move on to the next bit, where Jesus goes to Gennesaret. Now, Gennesaret is on the west side. It is just a few miles south of Capernaum, which is very close to West Bethsaida. Okay? So on the west, you've got West Bethsaida, Capernaum, Gennesaret, they're on the west. Now, this is where the boat pulls into. So after they've had this harrowing ordeal on the sea, this is where they go to. Which wasn't exactly where they were heading to. That wasn't where they set off for, but it's where they end up. So verse 34, it says, "And when they had crossed over," that means from northeast to the northwest, they came to land at Gennesaret. Okay? So, this was after the episode of the storm and the walking on the water. And then verse 35, "And when the men of that place recognized him, they sent round to all that region and brought to him all that were sick." So there they are, they land. So early that morning, when it gets light, they land at Gennesaret, and already people are up, and the word starts to get around that Jesus is here. So they start bringing out all the sick, and they're all coming down there, and they bring them to him. And it says in verse 36, "And they besought him," that means they asked him, pleaded with him, asked him, that they might only touch the fringe of his garment, and as many as touched it were made well. So they asked, "Can I touch your robe?" And when they say the fringe, what they're talking about here, they're talking about the tassels or the tzitzit, which Jesus wore on his robes. Now, he wore those in obedience to the law of Moses. And so, if you have a mental picture of Jesus, you possibly need to alter it. Because a lot of people that have a picture of Jesus is a very westernized person. They don't see him as Jewish. But he looked like a Jew, acted like a Jew, spoke like a Jew, and he thought like a Jew. That's what he was. And do you know something even more surprising? That's what he still is. And even more surprising, that's what he's always going to be. So we have a Jewish man who is going to be the king of the world. Now do you see why the devil hates the Jews so much? Do you see? And why people feel such hatred for them? The person that we are worshipping, we're Gentiles, we are worshipping a Jewish man. He also is the Son of God, the second person of the Trinity. But we mustn't get away from the fact that he is also a Jewish man. That's what he is. And he dresses like one. Look at him. "I don't wear any zit-zit or tassels on my robe. I don't even have any robes." But he did. And we mustn't picture him as being some kind of Westerner. It's not a trivial matter. We need to remember that he's Jewish. And that's what he is. Okay. And it's a mistake, and an important mistake, not to see that. But note that when they come to him, it says, "And as many as touched it," that means his robe, the fringe, "were made well." So they were healed. Why were they healed? Well, firstly, because he had compassion. We saw that last time. It was not because he was trying to prove his messiahship. He was no longer trying to prove that to them. He'd already proved it to the nth degree, but the people had rejected him. What these people, in the main, what many of them were looking for, was for what he could give them, how he could help them. But even though these will have included some of the people who rejected him, he healed them. But why did he do it? Out of compassion. But also because they had faith. Because the very fact that they came to him and touched his robe was a manifestation of faith. It was a physical act which represents faith. They came to him and they wanted to do it. In so doing, they were displaying faith. Now, what Jesus does, he responds now to those who have faith in him. When he first came, he healed anybody, regardless of whether they had faith. He just healed everybody, regardless. But what does it say here? As many as touched it. It doesn't say that he healed all the people in Gennesaret. He healed the people that came to him and touched his robe. Now we have a subgroup. Prior to this, he was going to, pulling into town, healing everybody, without regard to whether they believed in him or had faith in him, because he was demonstrating his messiahship. Here, he's not seeking to demonstrate that. That's stopped now. The offer of the kingdom has been withdrawn. We're going to enter into, as we saw in Matthew 13, the period of the mystery kingdom, which includes the church age. We're not going to have the kingdom until later. He's no longer trying to prove his messiahship or his kingship. He's no longer seeking to be made king. But he is healing people still, but not everybody. Just everybody who has faith. Do you see? A subgroup. Those who come to him, those who believe him. And that's still true now. We've got to have far more faith in him than we do. And most of us, as Westerners, we are just a pale, pale reflection of what we should be. We've had so much of the faith drained out of us. We're like a kind of, like a garment that's been left in the sun and been bleached. The colour's gone out of it. It's like a bleached garment. The faith that's in us is meant to be so much stronger and brighter and more vivid than it is. And life living amongst so much unbelief, for many of us, has drained the faith out of us. And we need to be aware of that and to change that. Get the faith back. Seek it. Develop it. Build it. Don't just be content with having a tiny level of faith. If you do have a tiny level of faith, then tell the truth. Admit it, you've got a tiny level of faith. But say, but I need to change that. And then set about doing so. Okay, well, that is the end of verse 36, the end of chapter 14 of Matthew. We'll stop at that point.